welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I am Michele Matarazzo from the HMCNAC in Madrid, Spain, and today we'll be talking about one of the most challenging problems we face in dystonia clinics, which is distinguishing functional dystonia from idiopathic dystonia, especially in those kind of gray zone cases where phenomenology alone doesn't fully settle the diagnosis. Joining me is Professor Roberto Eleopra, first author of a recent paper published in Movement Disorders titled Polyelectromyography Under Propofol to Differentiate Functional from Idiopathic Dystonia, a Pilot Study. Professor Eleopra is the chair of the Clinical Neuroscience Department and the Parkinson and Movement Disorder Unit at the Fondazione IRCCS and Istituto Neurologico Carlo Besta in Milan, Italy. Roberto, welcome to the podcast and thank you for being with me today.
Hello. Thank you, Michele, to invite me to this nice podcast. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Okay, let's start, Roberto. Could you briefly frame the problem for us? What is functional dystonia and why is it difficult to diagnose, also compared with other functional movement disorders?
Yes, functional dystonia is one of the most common and most diagnostically challenging form of functional movement disorder. This dysfunctional disorder involve abnormal movement that occur without structural damage of the nervous system, and they are typically recognized by clinical inconsistency and incongruence. These are the main features that we use for diagnosis of functional movement disorder. But functional dystonia is particularly difficult for the clinicians because it closely resembles idiopathic dystonia and sometimes presents an unusual or atypical feature. And also, if we consider the sudden onset, the fixed posture at rest or resistance of passive movement, it could be hypothetically a marker for a functional dystonia. But these features could also appear in idiopathic dystonia. So it's very difficult for the clinicians to understand and to identify what's the functional movement disorder, what's the idiopathic dystonia. And this is still depends on the experience of the neurologist and of the clinical interpretation. It is a common disorder. It is different also in the diagnosis when we compare tremor or myoclonus or other functional movement disorder, in which entrainment on some other clinical semiological features can help us to differentiate these entities.
So you were mentioning some of the signs that we usually use when we are evaluating a patient with suspected functional dystonia. But as you were mentioning, there is a lot of overlap with actual idiopathic dystonia, and that makes it very difficult. And I guess that's a problem also when you want to help the patients, because of course, the management of a patient with functional dystonia and idiopathic dystonia, it's different. And even for advanced therapies, it makes a huge difference. Now, you had a very different approach, which is really original, using polyelectromyography with a controlled propofol sedation protocol to see how muscle activity behaves across different stages of consciousness. What was the central hypothesis? What did you expect that propofol would reveal in functional dystonia as compared with idiopathic dystonia?
Yes, this is a start from the pathophysiology of the two different diseases. Idiopathic dystonia, we are thinking that there is a dysfunction of motor network involving the basal ganglia, the cerebellum, the primary and secondary somatosensory cortex. But there is also converging evidence point that in functional dystonia, there is only a cortical caudal rostral dysfunction without a true interest in the basal ganglia and in a network of the deeper neurological center. And this is important because when you use an anesthetic or you want to evaluate the patient during sleep, there is a different feature. There are some data, there are the older publication in which, for example, during sleep in idiopathic dystonia, there is a decrease in muscle activity when you recorded by poly EMG. but also in a condition in which there is a reduction of awake cortical status, there is a decrease in muscular activity. This is not really true for all the patients, but it could be the aim, the main concern about the evaluation during anesthesia, using anesthetic technique. And in psychiatry, there are also some therapeutic techniques based on anesthetic infusion, in which there are some relaxing or conditioning training, in which some psychiatric patients could evidence an improvement in clinical state. So it's important to understand that if we are able to evaluate the muscle activity as a final output of the motor system during different awake status, it could be possible, this is the hypothesis of our study, to differentiate functional from idiopathic dysfunction.
Great. So basically, the idea is that pathophysiologically, the idiopathic and the functional dystonia have a different topography in the brain, shutting down different parts of the brain, which happens in different states of the sedation, will reveal some differences in the poly-EMG exam.
Exactly. And the aim of our study, it was to identify neurophysiological biomarkers was capable to improve the differential diagnosis between functional and idiopathic. Because we know that the diagnosis category of the Gupta and Lange criteria, there are some missing points and some gaps when we want to identify the true idiopathic dystonia. And so if we decide to study well-defined 17 idiopathic dystonic patients in comparison to 10 clearly functional dystonic patients, based on the Gupta and Lange criteria. In this case, we compare and we match by age, sex, education, the pattern of dystonic distribution, the mode of onset, the present or absent of fixed posture, disease duration, and also the response of the botulinum toxin. And we also try to compare to match by mood and anxiety symptoms, and we want to evaluate what's happened when you induce a slowly and graduate anesthetic protocol by using propofol. We know that propofol is a prevalent action on the cortical layers, on the cortical network, and theoretically, if the dystonic is idiopathic dystonic, the main mechanism is subcortical in the basal ganglia and the integration with this somatosensory and motor, and it could be that is less influenced than the functional dystonia when the pathophysiological mechanism is prevalent cortical.
Okay, so I get the theoretical idea and most of the methodology, but I guess a lot of people reading this article was thinking about how complicated the whole protocol is. How feasible is it for a real life scenario? How long did the whole protocol take and how many resources do you need to do it? How complicated it is?
Yes, the protocol is not too complicated because it is the same protocol that you use when we apply MRI under anesthesia. So it's the infusion of propofol is no more than 20 minutes. We have a range between 14 and 28 minutes. All the patient is well tolerated, so the patient is safe. And we start with very low dosage of propofol, 1 microgram for ml for each patient. And it's not a bolus. It's an increase in 2 minutes, a step of at least 2 minutes. And we observe from a clinical point of view that the variation of conscience, but also we evaluate by EEG, and the BIST methods that anesthesiologists use it to understand the deeper anesthetic protocol. And we have only 2 recordings with electrodes in the muscle, with a mean of 10 muscles. So we have 20 minutes to prepare the patient and 20 minutes to do the test. And usually in 40 minutes, we complete the test and we applying in clinical practice when the patient starts the infusion for the MRI under sedation. It's very useful and very practiced to evaluate not only the pattern of EMG, but also the clinical state and what's happened to the dystonic pattern.
Great. So it is time consuming, but feasible nevertheless. Also outside of a research setting, it's 40 minutes is not something that you can do on a routine with all of the patients. With selected patients, it's something that is definitely feasible if it is helpful. Now, let's see if it is helpful. What are the main results of your study?
Okay, the main results are interesting because, of course, it's necessary to use in selected patients when we want to understand different questions. But the result is that in a weak state, of course, we have a typical EMG pattern of co-contraction, prolonged burst, sometimes the overflow of the recruitment in muscle involuntary hyperactivity. But we observe the same in the functional movement disorder. There is overlap. Of course, in some functional movement disorder, there is a variability in the recruitment, but this is not enough to differentiate this kind of population.
Can I just interrupt you 1 second? Maybe for some of the listeners who are not really into this, what is the co-contraction and what is the overflow that you're mentioning?
Okay. The co-contraction is when flexor or extensor muscle, antagonist muscle, have simultaneous contraction that is not physiological. When we flex some body part, there is a contraction of the synergic muscle and inhibition of the opposite muscle. In this case, in dystonic, is one of the characteristics the neurophysiology want to do diagnosis is a co-contraction between antagonist muscle. And another feature, when we repeat the movement, this involuntary activity extends by a topographic, for example, from distal to proximal part of the limbs. And this is another feature usually typical for organic, for idiopathic dystonia. And this is not usually observed in functional movement disorder. But it's not always true, because some functional movement disorder, there is a co-contraction. It is not easy to understand the distalability. And this is an important feature. So what's happened when we do the test during the progressive sedation, we didn't observe no so much difference. All the patients they tended to decrease the muscle activity, but in functional movement disorder, when we have a deep anesthesia protocol, there is a complete resolution in 100% of the patient of the muscle contraction. In idiopathic dystonia, in 53%, there is a persistent of the muscular contraction. So the first interpretation is if it's present, it could be an idiopathic dystonia, but more interesting in when we stop the infusion and there is a recovery in the slow progressive recovery in a week of the patient. There is a different change. The dystonic muscle reappear the same kind of voluntary contraction, the same pattern at the baseline early before the consciousness is completely recovered. But in functional movement disorder, there is a prolonged silence, and when appear, usually during the reappearance of consciousness, the patterns change from the baseline. And so these two main points at complete deep sedation and during the recovery is very useful to differentiate this kind of dystonia, this idiopathic dystonia from functional dystonia.
This seems really useful for these doubtful cases that sometimes, as you were mentioning, is difficult to differentiate functional from idiopathic dystonia. And now you showed this in this study. Obviously, this is very interesting. This is very novel. But do you think we should use this in clinical practice already? Or do we need more evidence, or this is enough?
Of course, I agree with you. This is a pilot study. There are some limitations. The first limitation is the sample size, because we have only 17 patients and 10 patients with functional dystonia. And also we select the patient in which the diagnosis but from a clinical point of view, it was certain. But if we are some unclear cases, we have to validate this test because probably it's appear more useful when there is and we are not able to differentiate a clear functional movement disorder from an idiopathic dystonia. The first thing is validating a more simple signs and to include more defined definitive case of functional idiopathic dystonia. And also we are trying to better quantify the EMG pattern because it's only a qualitative observation until this moment. Of course, we use a blinded neurophysiologist in order to understand what the pattern of EMG without evidence of functional of idiopathic dystonia, but we have to validate from some other quantitative measures.
And one thing that was interesting while I was reading the paper is that you not only used the EMG, but also the passive manipulation during this deep sedation. So the very clinical, hands-on, literally clinical aspect of this. Can you tell us a little bit what happened with the passive manipulation?
Yes, this is important for the clinicians because when you have a fixed posture, sometimes we are not able to understand if there is a true dystonic posture or there is a retraction from tendons or some osteoskeletal chains in bone. And so when the patient is under deep sedation, we are able to have a passive movement of segment of heart, of head. And it's easier for us to understand, for example, if a patient with a fixed posture could be a benefit from botulinum toxin or for DBS or from some other interventional therapy. Because if there is a retraction from bone or from some other osteoarthritis, this is a limitation to obtain a clinical improvement of the posture.
Perfect. We're getting close to the end of this interview. I wanted to ask, as you mentioned already, it is a pilot study. There are a few limitations, one of them in the sample size. And so you said already that we need to validate this in larger cohorts. Are you working on this or do you expect someone else to do it?
We are working on this. We are improving the sample size. And also we are including some uncertain keys in order to understand what's happened. And in particular, we are also trying to understand if there is some differences between genetic form of idiopathic dystonia and non-genetic form, because we know, for example, with the microelectrode recording during DBS, it could be possible to observe a different physiological pattern in genetic and in other different form or primary dystonia non-genetic. So this is what we are doing now in order to validate, to improve our data.
Roberto, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations for your study to you and your co-authors. This is a really thought-provoking pilot study. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me and for all the listening people that you are here with us.
And for our listeners, we've been discussing the paper published in Movement Disorders Journal titled Polyelectromyography Under Propofol to Differentiate Functional from Idiopathic Dystonia, a Pilot Study. Thank you all for listening.
If you enjoyed the conversation about this paper, you can further your experience with continuing medical credits, or CMEs. You can find the link to the journal CME course for this paper within the episode description on the MDS website. Journal CME is planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society is accredited by the ACCME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society designates this education activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.